Welcome to Unlimited Partners, a podcast on partnership. I'm your host, Thomas McGannon. I'm an investor on a journey to understand what makes great partnerships. This podcast is my way of recording that process and sharing it.
So when I was in college, one of my favorite experiences was starting a rugby team. I had never started an organization. I didn't know what it meant to recruit people to do something that I thought was interesting. And anyways, it was just a really fun opportunity. My favorite part of playing rugby wasn't actually the sport. It was the people. It was the relationships that I got to build with teammates. One of my favorite teammates, a very good friend, his name was Luke McAndrew. And if you met Luke, I mean, he was like the scruffy headed, disheveled, like late for everything. Like the guy was just a loosely functioning disaster. And we put him at scrum half, which is crazy because the scrum half in rugby is like the quarterback. So putting the ball in Luke's hands was something that few people would have done. But the reason that we did it was because Luke, more than anyone on the team, was just scrappy. He was a hustler. He was gritty. I once saw his index finger get dislocated in the middle of a play, and he popped it back in and just kept rolling. Like, he didn't say a freaking word to anybody. And I saw the way that, like, that made me tougher, more resilient, more committed to my teammates. And so as an investor, I'm always looking for the next Luke McAndrew. And Bruce Felt, he is my Luke McAndrew. I met Bruce in 2018 when his company Domo was coming public. At the time, Domo's financial profile was really unsettling. They were burning prodigious amounts of cash. I think if you were to add up their growth rate plus, or in this case, minus their cash flow margin, it was something like negative 120%. The highest quality software businesses can put up something in like the 80 to 90% range, meaning growth plus margin is 80 to 90%. High quality businesses are in the 40% range positive. And so when you found a company that was negative 120% coming public, like there was something not working there. What Domo does is they take data, which, you know, you've heard maybe the notion that data is the new oil. And that's true in the sense that, like, data is dirty. Data is heterogeneous. Data exists in all sorts of places inside and outside of an organization that are really hard to kind of like shape it and silo it and clean it into structured data sets to then put into charts and graphs to go onto people's phones to actually help make like an informed decision. And so that's a challenging journey to sign up for. And it's especially a challenging journey to sign up for when you're the CFO of that company, when you are responsible for articulating the financial performance of a business and you're responsible for steering the company in a direction of improvement. And when things have been so challenged in the past, like, I don't know, that's a tough job. And so when I met Bruce Felt in the fall of 2018, I thought to myself, like, there's no way this guy sticks it out. But what I came to learn is that Bruce is like Luke McAndrew. Bruce never gives up. Bruce is a hustler. Bruce commits to something, and his word is his bond. And in our conversation, we talk about, you know, when you came public and you told everybody you had enough money to turn the business cash flow positive, and no one believed you, including me. Like, and I will take ownership of that. Like, I'm Bruce's friend. I love the company. I think that they have a lot of cool stuff going on. I thought there was no flipping way that they were going to be able to turn the business cash flow positive. Domo came out of the pandemic in a much better spot. Their growth rate improved materially. Their sales and marketing efficiency, their operational discipline, just really found another gear that I didn't expect. And I learned this through having lots of customer conversations, mostly using the Tegas research platform, that I was able to talk to customers that were finding real world success in a breadth that I thought was just really special. Like, I was able to talk to people at Uber and Cisco and just all sorts of these random companies that were finding similar success. And so as a technology platform, I was really interested in Domo. And so when I started this podcast project and I was thinking about stories that I wanted to share, and one of the things that I'm wanting to accomplish here is, like, I don't want victory laps. I don't want people to come on and give this revisionist history about how they did something in the past. I want to talk to the boxer in the seventh round. Like, I want to have a real-time, what are you doing? How is it going? What are you excited about? What are you scared about? Because that's what I need in my life. I need the context for how to make decisions in real time. And so right now, in a more uncertain economic environment, I think that wartime leadership is needed. I think that the ability to make swift decisions that are not dependent on a reality that we may have had 6 or 9 months ago. And so when I think about the journey that a guy like Bruce has been on, I think this is a wartime leader. This is a conversation that I'd like to have now. Hey, everybody. Before we get into today's conversation, I need to give a shout out to some of our sponsoring partners. Unlimited Partners is brought to you by Tegas. It's fair to say that I built my technology investing career on the Tegas platform. Since joining as a beta customer back in 2017, I've personally conducted hundreds of primary expert interviews, and I've read or listened to more than 10 times that many using their searchable on-demand transcript database. I simply couldn't imagine making an investment or critical business decision without consulting the knowledge that's captured in their platform. So whether you're a professional investor, corporate development executive, or just someone who's looking for expert insights, give Tegas a try by visiting tegas.com. This is the legal disclaimer part. Unlimited Partners is not investing advice. The host and members of Unlimited Partners may have a position in the securities discussed. Please do your own research. Please enjoy my conversation with Bruce Felt, Chief Financial Officer of Domo. Bruce, thank you so much for doing this. So the way that I'd want to start this conversation, this is totally selfish and just kind of personal. We've interacted dozens of times, but Bruce, and I think this is kind of a condition of business, I don't really know that much about you. Would you mind just kind of sharing kind of who you are, anything about your background? Like, what do you enjoy doing? What makes you really happy?
Sure. I mean, most people don't fundamentally want anything to do with me, so they don't ever ask, but thank you for asking. But I'll say I'm a product of a varied background. I grew up as a Navy brat, lived in 18 places in 18 years, so kind of a nomad, and that absolutely kind of influenced maybe my appetite to either move around or my appetite for risk, just because you're always put in very strange places and have to think quickly and stand on your 2 feet. So that's the one part of my background. On a professional sense, I ended up doing 2 tours of duty, or my father did, in the Southeast. So I say I'm from the Southeast just because I ended up graduating from high school there, even though I went to 3 high schools, believe it or not. Started my career in public accounting in Atlanta, Georgia. Did very well. Was a senior manager at Deloitte & Touche at the time, not just Deloitte. And was the step before partner as fast as one could be. And I had extremely interesting clients, so much so that I wanted to really understand what drove their strategy and why they were entering into very interesting transactions that I could support as a member of the kind of audit team at Deloitte, but I couldn't really provide business guidance. So that led me to head out west to go to Stanford Business School. And I and the whole purpose was not a career change. The whole purpose was just to learn more. And as luck would have it, in my last semester at business school, a few of us got together and wrote a business plan to start a software company when none of us had run a company before. And as luck would have it, we got funded. And so we started a software company. And that's what got me into Silicon Valley and made me stay there and stay in software. And I'll just say one of the most interesting aspects of that first journey in software was I ended up running sales for the organization. So even though I'm kind of a CFO by trade and profession, I ran a sales organization for 3 years, and the revenue was $2 million the first year, $6 million the second, and $18 million the third. So it was quite a run, and it got bought by SunGard. And from there, I put the experience as running sales in my pocket to try to make me a better chief financial officer. And from there, I just went from, you know, one technology company to another. You know, as we get through Domo, three IPOs, five very successful exits, all high growth. And, you know, as soon as SaaS came on the scene, the software orientation went from, you know, client server or desktop oriented to SaaS. And I've been doing SaaS ever since.
I think that's a great start. And one of the themes that's come up a lot in my conversations with people in the Domo ecosystem is that you, for much of Domo's life, you've been one of the best sales leaders there. That nobody can demo Domo better than Bruce Felt. I think that when I first met you, your time at SuccessFactors was what most people talked about. Could you share just a little bit about that experience? You did lead that company through the great financial crisis. And I have a sense that from a leadership perspective, that experience formed a lot of the Bruce that we know today.
Well, it certainly played an important part when COVID hit and we saw a potential meltdown in the economy that actually did happen to some degree, certainly certain industries, less so in other industries. So that experience was extremely helpful facing that challenge. And in fact, I even put together a webinar for internal and external use on how do you manage a business through a macro meltdown or a recession. And we actually used the model of how the top line was affected at SuccessFactors to model out what we suspected could happen at Domo. And we used, you know, that experience to make our cut decisions. In hindsight, the cuts weren't necessary because our top line was able to be maintained because we responded so quickly with our ability to develop apps and sell them in a very appropriate manner to help companies in the COVID crisis. But the broader experience at SuccessFactors included, you know, working with a very large TAM where everybody, every employee in every company ought to be using SuccessFactors. That very much applied at Domo. SuccessFactors was very high growth. We're applying those same principles, you know, as we sit here right now at Domo, which started more of a product-led orientation. And we became at SuccessFactors a very strategic asset that ultimately was very attractive to SAP. At Domo, I think we're extremely strategic asset, even more so than SuccessFactors, because of the size of the TAM and then the need to modernize data infrastructure and getting data out in the hands of everyone in the business, something that's been a challenge for decades. And we finally delivered it. But what makes us even that much more attractive is the fact that with Domo, sales forces can literally sell to CEOs and CMOs and CFOs of some of the largest companies in the world. And that's highly attractive to very aggressive sales-driven companies.
I got to spend some time with Chris Harrington, where he would talk about that the early days. I think there was like an IHOP meeting at 2 a.m. where Josh James pulls out his phone and says, "We're going to build a company that allows people to run their businesses from their phone." Seeing now the dominance of a mobile defined world and knowing myself just how critical, how core my mobile device is to the way that I run my business. Like, I think that was a pretty prescient perspective to have had, building the technology and the go-to-market to serve that need. I think, as you guys have learned, has been a Herculean lift. What was the world like for you when you first discovered Domo? And if you could just share some of the thoughts and conversations that you had around the time that you decided to join Domo.
Well, I'll say there were two major drivers for me joining. One of them was the fact that many of the same, literally the same investors and the same principles from those investors that I had at SuccessFactors were already at Domo. And they had incredible respect for the company and for Josh and for the opportunity. So they were highly encouraging me to really evaluate the opportunity. And there's a lot of comfort walking into a situation where you know the board very well on day one. The second, it's kind of equally important, was I really understood the issue that was trying to be solved, the problem that was trying to be solved. And this goes back in many ways to the SuccessFactors days. SuccessFactors was in the goal setting business. And we were already contemplating how much more powerful our product could be if we had the actual results tied in to the goal setting process. And we were already heading in that direction. So I knew the importance of that on the one hand, and was already very familiar with, you know, the issue at hand. And at the same time, just as a business leader, I also experienced, like everybody, like many other business leaders, just the difficulty of really staying on top of your business by having data that's either current enough or relevant enough or accessible enough. And so between the investor set and then the problem set they were solving, it made complete sense for me to join Domo.
If you could just kind of like walk through what Domo is in the context of the broader software ecosystem, I think that'd be really helpful.
Right. The genesis of Domo was really based on the observation that BI and big data infrastructure had been around for decades. Yet companies as a whole were not getting the data that they needed that was timely and consumable and relevant and flexible, and where it was just incredible efforts to get the information. And often it just was not delivered. And that was puzzling. Extremely puzzling. Trying to solve that problem became so complex that the IT departments had to step in and own the problem. And when that happened, everything got bottlenecked behind their capability to deliver information out to businesses. IT departments are just a small part of most organizations. They get extremely busy on data requirements and other things. And ultimately, the businesses were not served the data that they needed and need to really aggressively run their business. So Domo embarked on solving that problem. And the biggest surprise was Domo assumed, when embarking on that problem to solve, that all the data was already organized and all it had to do was be delivered on a phone so that it can be in everybody's hands or in their pockets so they can make decisions just right there on the spot. To Domo's surprise, the data was not available. It was in this data warehouse or that data warehouse, or is in a SaaS application. It was in an on-premise application, a client-server application. It was in something, but not readily available to be delivered and used by companies. Because we found that to be the case, Domo had to build a complete stack that connected the data. You know, we now have 1,000 data connectors that clean the data, that harmonize the data, that created new data sets out of all that. Then they had to have the ability to store it, ultimately in a data warehouse in the cloud. It was required to be cloud-based. Then we had to visualize it. And ultimately, that wasn't even enough. Companies wanted to interact with the data in very unique ways that caused us to develop a low-code, no-code application development environment. And then, of course, why don't we let the computers do a lot of the thinking for us, since it's all the data is digitized, and that's where machine learning and AI come into place. So we actually embarked on solving that and solved it. So this is what makes us so unique. We are unique in our ability to deliver data in a very consumer-like, business-friendly form to distribute to everyone in a company, so they can become data experts in their own right and don't need technical backgrounds in order to get, consume, interact, and even create and connect to data. So everybody in the business can do that. And that makes us extremely unique, one of a kind. And it really is ultimately the moat that we have around us as a complete differentiator compared to any other product that's out there today.
Yeah, as we've joked about over the years, I've done an inordinate number of customer and former employee research calls, mostly using Tegas. And what always fascinated me about Domo and just kept me coming back wanting to learn more was this dynamic that your customers, whether they're large health systems or disruptive technology businesses like Uber, the line of business professionals that are actually delivering the goods of what Domo brings to bear, I mean, they are like magnanimous in the way that they talk about what it does for their careers. I mean, people tell me, I'll never forget being at one of your user events, Domopalooza, seeing a childhood band favorite of mine, Boys to Men, and an engineer from Uber literally yelling to me, "Domo makes me a superhero at Uber." And I think that the end goal that you guys are capable of driving to is really special, and it's what has made me as an investor so drawn to your your story. I think the opportunity that I've had as an investor to learn about your business is the product of you guys working through a lot of challenges, and so I'd like to maybe continue from your observation that we made some assumptions about the data landscape that ended up not being correct, and that the data universe is really messy, really heterogeneous. Did that realization occur in terms of just how much would have to be built for Domo to deliver on its stated goal? How did that realization that this was a much bigger infrastructure build, how did that unfold? Was that something that was known at the time when you joined as CFO, or were those incremental learnings, or was there a big watershed moment? Because I think that the implications have been, you know, a need of several $100 million of R&D work that you guys have done, and you being the CFO, I can't think of a better person to ask about this.
Yeah, I would say by the time I joined, it was absolutely realized that this was going to be a much heavier technical lift than originally imagined, as evidenced by the, you know, hundreds of millions of funding that had already occurred. And then, you know, as I was there, 500 million plus added on top of that. So it was understood, and the company was making great progress in building out one of the key components of solving that problem, which is the connector layer. And there were still many more to do and still improvements on those that existed. And the company was still kind of navigating what the total population of those needed to be. At that time, it was not known it needed to be about 1,000. But we were all, you know, we were already well into our way of developing many of these. One of the assumptions was, you know, the top 100 connectors pretty much make up a substantial majority of all the data flows. So at one point, the assumption was if we could do that, then we've probably solved the problem. But I believe to really have the impact on the business that we need, all the data has to be available, because that missing 10 or 20% really could be the difference between really having what you need to perfectly know what to do and really measure exactly what you need to be successful versus not. So we had to continue to build that out. The bigger surprise was not the technical challenge required to deliver on the promise. The bigger surprise was the large enterprises as a whole had already developed so much infrastructure that even with us delivering on the promise, that was the whole point of their existence with respect to data and data delivery. Even though we delivered on the promise, they were not interested in buying Domo as a platform because they had already built the infrastructure, and they were much more interested in finding unique and specialized tools that help them ultimately solve the final problem that they were trying to solve. So the Domo platform, as powerful as it was not readily accepted by the largest enterprises in the world as a whole. Now, at department levels or very specific use cases, we were extremely well accepted. So we've had that was fundamentally, that point has been the genesis of an incredible amount of adjustments that we've made, that we've needed to make in our go-to-market efforts. And, you know, as we sit here now, we've overcome an incredible number of objections in that area of how we go to market, with still a lot more progress I think we can make and are making. But that was kind of the incredible surprise for us at Domo, that we actually built the perfect solution. And there's a whole segment of the market that found it, we found a whole segment of the market that on its face just wasn't really prepared to acquire it.
I think that what you guys built and your point of view on the IT departments being the choke point to realizing a lot of the hopes and aspirations of digital transformation, it makes a ton of sense to me now in hindsight how and why you guys found yourselves in that situation where you had built to the need that I think that we all would agree is preferable over the output that we were getting. But I think my understanding initially was that it was, you know, this isn't an IT department conversation. We're just going to go to the CFO, the CEO, and then we'll have this clearly superior strategy kind of dictated downwards. The IT departments, I think, in certain situations became a little bit in opposition to Domo adoption. Could you talk about your relationship, your evolving relationship with the IT department?
The way we went to market was just really right at the business user, because that was our whole point of view and that was our target customer. And we did land quite a few very large enterprise customers. Where we ran into problems, however, was when it started to expand within that department or started to become bigger by jumping to other departments, the IT department would step in and it would slow down the process considerably. In some cases, we were greeted with skepticism, but openness, and we were able to overcome those situations. But sometimes with animosity, if the IT department believed the business side or Domo or the combination of us were working around them in creating what they would call shadow IT, that became problematic for us. Our messaging at the time with respect to IT, you know, the business message was, you can pay for this by replacing other technologies that that we've already developed in the platform. And for a business user, they go, that's great. You mean you're giving it to me for free because I can go replace, you know, other technologies and tools in my business? And the answer was yes. Well, that messaging, as strong as it was on the business side, was absolutely counterproductive when it was heard by the IT departments, who had already invested millions or tens of millions or tens and tens of millions into their infrastructure. And they were not about to decommission any of it until they decided that they wanted to adopt a product or platform like Domo. So that messaging really was problematic for us. So since then, we've developed messaging that's much, much more IT friendly, with the basic tagline being BI leverage at cloud scale in record time, with an emphasis on we provide BI leverage, meaning to the IT department, we will really allow you through Domo to realize the vision you've always wanted to realize with all the data infrastructure you've already put in place. So why don't you just have Domo sit on top of that and you go serve the needs of the business in a way that really is not possible otherwise. And Domo, basically, compared to all the cost of the infrastructure, is just a minor cost, but the value that's delivered is incredible.
Hey everybody, we're gonna take a quick break to hear from my good friend, Courtney Hope, founder of My Marketplace Builder, a software as a service platform powering many of the next generation marketplace ideas.
Let's talk about My Marketplace Builder. Courtney, what is My Marketplace Builder?
So My Marketplace Builder is SaaS software for making marketplaces. With our software, you can get any kind of marketplace idea, whether it's product, service, or rental, get on the site, sign up for a free trial, and start taking transactions as quickly as the next day. The other part of the marketplace that we do is we also do customizations. So anything from first-time entrepreneurs all the way to Fortune 100 companies, we can go through and we can customize any pieces that you want from our featured library that has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of features to choose from too.
That's awesome. One of my favorite parts about working with you and researching your business is when I get to listen to your customer conversations. Can you talk about some of the customers that you guys work with?
Yeah, and that's something that's really exciting to us, the different kinds of marketplace ideas that people come up with. It really is the future of the world right now. Exactly how Shopify did it with the e-commerce world, where people needed to go through and sell their stuff online. We're doing that with the marketplace spots. We have anything from crawfish sourcing for restaurants all the way up to 18-wheeler parts to working with companies like Goodwill. And there's no limits to how you want to grow your marketplace and how do you want to do it or what your marketplace idea is.
So the website is mymarketplacebuilder.com. If you have a marketplace idea, then please go check them out. Thanks so much, Courtney. We'll look forward to hearing more from you later this season.
Yeah, I can't wait, Thomas. Thank you.
You guys have made a tremendous amount of progress. I remember you guys coming public really well, and I don't think that many investors believed you guys when you said that you would have enough cash to turn the ship and to become cash flow positive. I would love to hear what were some of the bases for you having confidence that would be a commitment that you could follow through on. And then also, I'd love to hear, what is it like, how as a leader do you handle a situation where the world is telling you no, but you're trying to drive in the direction of yes?
Well, at the onset, I did not know that very few, if any, people believed us. Even our big investors at the IPO and even our biggest fans, for lack of a better word, said, oh, I had you down for one or two financings. They said, just there's no way we believed you could do it. And so it was kind of surprising to me just at the start, because we made the commitment, we meant it, and we thought we were pretty clear about it.
What were the areas of spend that were not productive. And as time has passed, I actually think counterproductive. Like I don't think it's the perfect analogy, but I think about that I Love Lucy scene where they're on the chocolate conveyor belt and it's just piling up. Like, how did you lead in that time?
Well, there were I guess two major things. One was just from a macro point of view, we just had to put the boundaries of what we could and could not do. So what we decided we could not do and we could not afford to do is we cannot afford to invest as much in the marketing lead generation processes that we had historically done. That automatically really cut out something like $20 to $30 million of marketing spend, which was substantial. And then related to that, how do we adjust the business given the macro call? So at the time when we went public, we decided that if we were going to cut that much out of marketing, the corporate business was actually going to be severely restricted. The SMB more oriented business would be severely restricted because they were logically getting the most benefit out of the marketing spending that we were doing. And therefore, we put in a much greater focus on the enterprise. What ended up happening, not that this is part of the answer, but what ended up happening was the corporate business actually was resilient through that, which was a major learning for us, which made us realize that that there was a real good product market fit there, that there were really good, there's really good sales talent there, that in the end, the marketing lead generation was necessary up to a degree, but not nearly to the degree that we were spending it. And it was a real maybe core driver for future growth that we didn't really suspect could be that strong given what we're doing to the investment side of the equation. So the macro call mattered a lot. From a micro business point of view, we did get into the weeds on what kind of spending is generating the most return. What are the components of CAC? What's off market? What's on market? How do we drive to benchmarks and then studying what's working and what's not working, iterating even faster in favor of like the parts of the business that seem to have less friction and are working well versus and taking away from those that seem to have more friction where we need to spend more time to figure out what the right answer is before we can, you know, invest more in that.
Whenever I come to your events, I always make it a point to sit in the lunchroom from like beginning to end. So I do end up eating at least two lunches. You guys always have good food, so I much appreciate that. But what I love doing, why I enjoy doing that is I just love talking to your customers and the way that they talk about fostering data curiosity across the organization. I just think is really interesting. Like it's the part of software eating the world that makes me excited. You know, I think there had to have been, and maybe there wasn't, and you can just correct this, but there had to be some frustration, some fiefdom, some feeling of being defeated, of being defensive over why certain things might not be working. Like, how did you assess that situation? How did you kind of empower people to find what's working, to develop ways of measuring that, and then socialize that through the organization? Like, how that actually happened, the interpersonal process that needed to be put in place, has been something that I've always been really interested in.
Well, the one thing that has always motivated us was the mission we were on. We knew and know at the end of the day, this can't be replicated. It's too hard to do. The knowledge we have cannot be, no other company can do what we did. We've seen others claim to be able to do what we do and they failed. Very large companies, as a matter of fact, that wanted to be a competitor of ours that just have not done well. So that motivation has kind of overridden, that was enough motivation to override all the knocks that we took on go-to-market and just keep at it. And I would still say we aren't out of the clear yet. We're still trying to find ways to really conquer the enterprise. We think we can land faster. We think we can expand faster. We think we can get the support of the IT department. Certain things we're doing are working very well. We just need to do more of it. So we're still in that, and we're still highly motivated to keep at it until we finally reach the full potential of what we believe we can do as a company.
I'd love to, I mean, would it be possible, or would it be sensible to highlight a specific modification or play that you guys have found to be successful? I don't know if that's the right tree to be barking up, but it does seem like that has been somewhat of an unlock for you guys.
No, you're onto something that's extremely important. You know, this space is massive. It might be the biggest space around, right? I mean, big data, business analytics, reporting, the whole thing. I mean, it could touch every employee in a company. It can touch every customer of a customer. It can touch every supplier of a customer. I mean, this is a big, big market. And therefore, there's an incredible amount of noise in the market. I mean, everybody, sometimes I'm just amazed what the vendors say in the space. It's so similar to what we say, and I know they don't do it. So that's a source of frustration when they replicate our messaging or see the same vision we do when we deliver and they don't. So what's born out of that is the concept that, well, one way to cut through the noise is to show the product. Because if you see it, you believe it. This is why, to your point earlier, I demo to other CFOs. When they see it, they say, I want it. If I was just conceptually having a conversation about digitizing your business or making real-time decisions, I mean, intellectually, I think they get it and we can sell that way, but show them the product and all of a sudden it's an experience that they've never seen before. So if that's that important, then there's a couple things we can do. One of them, well, let's do proof of concepts. Let's just show them we can do what nobody else can do. That's very straightforward, and let's lean into that. And when we do that, we have incredible success.
Would you be able to tell a story about the ways in which your customers can adopt, embed Domo, and then present it down to that customer's customer? Because I think that is a really interesting and potentially like transformational. You guys are already dealing with a large total addressable market, huge. The serviceable addressable market that you create by enabling your customers to serve their customers in a more data informed, modern, cloud native manner.
So there are many, many cases where our customers are offering data products to their customers, just outright in that case. There are other customers that are not only offering data products, that is information or data about the relationship. It could be, you know, a tight supplier in a retail setting where they want to give the customer information about service levels, inventory levels, supply commitments, delivery commitments, and then allow their customer, not only to get that information, but marry it with their own information to compare that vendor to other vendors. I mean, the possibilities are endless.
I'd love to maybe, as we start to move somewhat to the exit here, I'd love to talk about COVID, because I remember early in the pandemic, you guys had an analyst session, and it was right when, you know, things were really disorienting. I'm going to say March 17th or 18th timeframe, and you had an earthquake during your analyst day. And I just remembered thinking, oh my God, this is what God telling you, like, this will not end well. And if you would have told me going into the pandemic that Domo would come out with a materially improved margin profile and accelerated top line growth. Like, I would have not believed you. I would have bet against that, and I would have been wrong in the way that I was wrong about so much about what the pandemic ended up bringing. Could you just share some of the story for how you guys acted in those early days and the way in which that kind of created some really good momentum for everybody to compound around? I think that, you know, leaders always aspire to come out of challenging situations stronger. And this is kind of at the core of why I wanted to talk to you about this, because I think you guys actually did it. And I think there are some potentially really interesting lessons there.
Yeah, I mean, that was a crazy time. COVID's hitting. We're talking about, you know, to investors, what might we do? You know, we said, well, if we have to cut, we will cut. I don't believe they believed us at that point in time, but we meant it. We said it. The earthquake hit. So God was telling us you shouldn't go to work today. Then we went anyway and did Domopalooza virtually with 500 pound, like, beams hanging and equipment hanging that people had to worry about them falling on us. I mean, it was something else. But we did say, look, we will cut if we need to cut. If we see anything going on in the business that looks like we're in harm's way because of the macro or because of what COVID will generate, we will cut. That was founded in many ways, you know, the experience we had 2008, 2009. It was ugly back then. Top lines got demolished. We all had to cut. And, you know, SuccessFactors, we kind of went from, we were cash positive, but we weren't operating income positive. We became operating income positive overnight. So we know how the bottom line works when you cut, when you have a SaaS business, because it's recurring business that's highly rich in margin. So all you have to do is cut back on the new business initiatives and you will get to profitability or cash flow positive fundamentally, you know, overnight. But, you know, as COVID was hitting, I guess the motivating factor was fear, you know, fear of what bad things could happen to us. So even though it was not happening, we decided to cut anyway and be preemptive. The thought was, well, I don't know how we are immune to this as a basic principle, so we need to cut. But the other side of it was also, you know, we've been growing and growing the business for quite some time. We haven't had a cut. So I know that we could live through a reasonable cut and it will not harm the business almost in any way. So you have fear on the one hand of how bad it could get. And well, we've never really done one. We've always been in growth, 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 go, go, go mode. Why don't we take this opportunity just to, like, really think about the cost structure, really align behind the talent we think will carry us on and make adjustments to the workforce. And so we went ahead and did it even without it hitting our top line. Now, certain industries were starting to get decimated. Travel, you know, hospitality, in-person retail. And we saw that in our pipeline. So one thing I give us credit for is we quickly pivoted away from the troubled industries and took those resources and put them on those industries that we thought were much more resilient. For example, in-person retail was getting decimated, but the e-commerce side was not. So let's focus on the e-commerce side. And so we made all kinds of those adjustments. And then out of fear also, and opportunity by the fact that we had such a good platform where you can build these apps overnight, we saw an opportunity to go deliver to three states the ability for them to manage through the crisis themselves. So here we are with all this data infrastructure. We decided, aren't we in the best position to give clarity as to what's going on with the state, what's going on with COVID cases, what's going on with hospitals, what's going on with supplies, you know, masks, you know, all that information that states needed. We go like, we can connect all their data sources and deliver in an app information that they just cannot get otherwise and deliver it so perfectly, they'll buy the product from us. And they did. And so because of that, we were able to like maintain the top line and the top line momentum, even though the macro, certain industries were really getting decimated and it looked like there was an overall slowdown everywhere.
That's really amazing what what fear plus so people will talk about how you know, opportunity is where, or luck is where opportunity and hard work meet. I think that fear is probably one of the underappreciated drivers of lucky outcomes.
Yeah. Well, I would say it wasn't this case. I mean, the world's falling apart around you. You better step up your game.
You talked about just this conviction that what you built at Doma was really hard and ultimately would prove really valuable. But just from an interpersonal perspective, like, how did you keep the faith and how did you try and be one of those people that helped the rest of the team stick this out?
Well, yeah, part of it is the conviction that we really had something here. But on the personal side, I hate to quit. I mean, I've been in so many situations where it would have been so easy to quit. I just hate it. And I kind of joke, you know, I stay around until they literally throw me out. And usually it's like in a good way. Like SAP bought SuccessFactors. So, you know, of course there wasn't a role for me. I kind of joke, well, they had to throw me out in a good way. But I just hate quitting. I've never wanted to do it. If I joined a sports team where it was so hard or hot or no role for me, whatever, I still didn't quit. I just hung in there and did whatever it took to like make it work. And I've always been that way. So, you know, that's just the personal side. I mean, I really, really would, it takes a lot to have me leave. And, you know, it's why I've been here through some tough times, but I just kind of persevere. And I usually just have faith that in the end, if I stick to it, and I know we have a good value prop here, that it will work out in the end. So have we reached the promise? And I'm kind of motivated by the fact we haven't reached the promise here yet. The best is still yet to come. And I would rather be a part of it than not, even if there were more attractive things that I could have done with my time.
Yeah, I think there's real wisdom in approaching life as an infinite game. And as soon as you've caught the tiger by the tail, like, good luck. That's going to be one of the darker times in your life, because, you know, it's getting to the top. It's like it is kind of that constant pursuit. That grind is where you kind of find who you are. And yeah, I mean, with the business, I think, you know, under a $2 billion market cap and targeting a $1 billion, very high margin, high net retention, plus 100% net customer growth. Like, I think there's lots of reason for optimism there. Well, Bruce, I want to say thank you for taking this time to talk with me. I really appreciate what you've done for me, just as you know, somebody who's accommodated an investor who's wanted to learn about your business. And I do. I really respect what you and the team have done there. And I can't wait to see what the future holds for y'all.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank you for your interest and your, you know, the amount of effort you put into like understanding the story and all the calls you made to customers and to employees. So that takes a lot of perseverance on your part, a lot of intellectual curiosity as well, which I find seems to be one of your traits. So I'm happy to have spent this time with you. I hope you and others might get some value out of it.
Thank you so much, Bruce. All right, man. Take care. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye now.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. This has been an Unlimited Partners production. The show is edited and produced by Andrew Thomas.
and our music was composed by Nick Samaska. Thanks again, and we'll see you guys next week. If you'd like to receive more Unlimited Partners content, then please sign up for our private podcast feed. You can do that by visiting our website or by hitting us up with a Twitter DM. We plan to use this feed for releasing longer form, uncut episodes, live recordings, and experiments with the types of interviews and content that we produce. If you'd like to learn more about sponsoring Unlimited Partners, then please say hi. Email us at sponsor@up-pod.com.